Hi, I'm Maris Kreisman. Welcome to the Maris Review. I am joined today by someone I feel like I know, but it's really just through the internet. Annie Hartnett is the author of Rabbit Cake, which was listed as one of Kirkus Review's best books of 2017 and a finalist for the New England Book Award. When she began writing her second novel, Unlikely Animals, she was living in the groundskeeper's house in a cemetery. She now lives in a small town in Massachusetts with her husband, daughter, and darling border collie, Mr. Willie Nelson. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me. And I feel like I know you too.
It took me until I read your author's note at the end of the book, and this is not a spoiler per se, to fully grasp the idea that Corbin Park is real. I really thought it had to be an invention. Tell me about the lore of Corbin Park.
Yeah, so this place, I mean, so when, you know, you just read in my bio that I was living in a cemetery when I started the book, which is where I lived in when I was an MFA student in Alabama. I moved there right after a tornado. And so a lot of the graduate student housing had been sort of really damaged, if not totally gone, in the tornado. So we moved into a house that was in a graveyard. And so I was writing a book there, but right before I left, I was writing Rabbit Cake, but then I had a professor who said, like, start another book too, so you'll have something in the back burner. So I started this book there, but it was a really different version. There was actually, it had nothing to do with the graveyard. I was writing this book for many years in the background of writing Rabbit Cake, which was about a woman who returned to a town and was a substitute teacher. But I was not very much in love with it for a long time. And it just like paled into comparison to how I felt about Rabbit Cake. And I have a friend, Tessa Fontaine, who wrote this amazing memoir, The Electric Woman. And we started talking about second books, and she was like, it's just the first cut is the deepest, like that's the only one you really ever love. And so maybe I was like trying to work through that. And then in 2008, maybe it was end of 2017. So Rabbit Cake came out into that 2017. So I'm up in New Hampshire visiting some friends, and I am driving along this like forested road, covered bridge, little pond. There's really not much else on this road. And I look up, and like sort of from the heavens, there's this enormous yellow mansion that looks like the nicest hotel you've ever seen. And I'm like, ask my friends, like, what is that place? And they had just moved there, so they had not seen it before, and they had no idea. So I Google, you know, Newport, New Hampshire, enormous yellow mansion. It's not a town where there's any other mansions. Find out that it's this Gilded Age robber baron who had retired there, and he had been born there, and he moved back there as his like retirement home. And he knocked down the house he was born in, except for the room he was born in. Wow. And I don't really know if that's completely true, but that's like the mythology of it, which I just think is so creepy and weird. Another person told me it was like he kept the house and built the mansion around it, but whatever it is, he built it somewhere around that house. And it's this huge, beautiful, onion-domed mansion. And so I think that that's very interesting and cool, especially it's still in its beautiful grandeur. And then I find out that as his retirement project, he bought up 60 farms and fenced it all that land in, and it became Corbin Park. His name was Austin Corbin, and it's a 26,000 acres that he shipped animals from all over the world. And I love animals, and this just was so wild to me. So I start, and then I discover, but I didn't really, wasn't thinking I was going to write about it. I was just like, I just found this cool thing. And then I find out that the park is still there today, and that it's still intact as 26,000 acres, and it's private property. It was sold out of the Corbin family after they were like all bankrupt after World War II. And so they, it's still there. It belongs to about 25 anonymous millionaire hunters who just like each have a share of the land. And I was fascinated with that because I was right. I will always write books that are sort of set now-ish or like recent mm-hmm. history, because I like my characters have cell phones and use the internet and like tell jokes that I think are funny. And so I started researching it anyway, because I was just obsessed and my friends had a place up there I could stay. So I started going to the historical societies in the area. So as I'm in the historical society, researching the Newport Historical Society, there's a couple of historical societies because the park spans five different towns. Sure. So I went to a few, but I'm sitting in the attic up there just going through the stuff. And I found this guy, Ernest Harold Baines, who was a naturalist for the park from 1904 to 1925. And he was a real life Dr. Doolittle with animals in his house, fox, bear, two bison. Well, the bison, I don't think ever went in the house, but he had a deer that did go in the house. And a, well, those are the main ones. The bear and the fox are the ones that are show up in my book. And then he, so I was just obsessed with him and then started talking to people about him. And then when I think that the real final thing that locked into me was, I was like, he belongs in my book. When someone said, I'm sitting in the library talking, asking questions about Ernest Harold Baines. And this guy sitting at the table just goes, who wasn't even like the librarian. He was just some guy. Who, I mean, he's not some guy. He's a historian of his own, but he's just sitting there and he overhears me and says, oh, he was quite the womanizer. Mm-hmm. And as though I'm talking about someone who still lives in the town, you know, and this guy died in 1925. And that was just so amazing to me. So because that was already kind of going on in the book with the dad who is, mm-hmm. you know, who is dying in 2014 when the book begins, who is a woman. He's a womanizer. Yeah, sure. And so that at that point, I made Ernest Harold Baines a ghost in the book, and he was the first ghost who appeared. And then I'm able to, because everything's in public domain, it's only been in public domain for like 2 years, all his writing. So I'm able to put his real writing and his photographs in the book. And then also able to mess with them because they don't.
Public domain. It's like.
But they're real stories about the animals. So it's everything.
The best version of fan fiction.
Yeah, totally. You could just copy and paste.
So once you grasped hold of the idea that Harold Baines would appear as a ghost, then you had to kind of create rules for this world that you're depicting. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So the rules came about. So Ernest Harold Baines showed up as a ghost. And I didn't have to worry about the rules until I started adding ghosts. So at first it was like, I wanted to write this, and I know you like him too, I think from Twitter at some point. I wanted to write like a John Irving type, like omniscient narrator who knows everything. But what I had was a omniscient narrator who had too much personality. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't. An omniscient narrator who knew everything, but also was like always cracking jokes. And so I had a friend, Lucas Mann, who said, you know, who is talking? And I was like, don't worry about it. I don't care. And then so I was up at McDowell and I was like, I should probably address Lucas's concern at this point, and someone should be talking. And that is where Thornton Wilder wrote Our Town. And so, you know, it kind of was like, mm-hmm. clicked for me that would make sense in the book where I already had a ghost, that it would be the cemetery and and there was so much about the town anyway. And there's like, I that's with the history, like who would care about the things that I was obsessed about, which is like this town right now or in 2014 and this town 130 years ago. It's like the people who were either there or have the dead people in the town. So I tried that out. I was worried about doing it because Lincoln and the Bardo had been out like maybe the year before when I started doing that. And I love Lincoln Lombardo, but so I showed it to some friends and they were like, this is all you, and it's a different story, and it's
sure,
you know, you're gonna, it's so, it's just nothing. I both was scared to do it, and then once I did it, it like made perfect sense to me. So once I had those ghosts, and the cemetery, that was the, and I had to divide the divide between the ghosts in the cemetery, who were the narrators, and then the ghost, Ernest Harold Baines, who is really like with the family in the house. And luckily, Ernest Harold Baines really was cremated. So that really Great helped people. Me just like, okay, well, there's a difference here. There's ghosts in the cemetery, and then there's Ernest Harold Baines, who was cremated and sprinkled in the park. And so I was able to make that joke, which just often I'll just make a joke and then the plot comes from there. So I first probably just made the joke about like, he's got different, like, so in the book, people who are cremated are doomed or gifted, whatever you, however you want to think about it, to walk the town for the rest of eternity. And then the people who are in the cemetery are like, they're stuck there to sit there and gossip and watch everything like they're watching television. And so they have different sort of modes of the afterlife. And that was the first rule. And then from there, because there's a bit of a mystery going on in the book, and the ghosts know everything within town limits, I had to come up with rules about why they're not solving the mystery for us. So this I talked through a lot with my agent about, I think she's a little witchy, my agent, Katie Grimm, who I love. And so she was very useful of having these conversations about like, well, you know, of course ghosts don't solve everything for us. Otherwise we would just like always have psychics on the hotline. And then, you know, if you really believe in ghosts, like why aren't they solving everything for us? And so I had to kind of come up with, you know, my own logic in the book, and that both, I think the things that guided me most is that there had to be consequences for them meddling too much in the living, that they really want to help. And then the other thing is thinking about how much they really love the living. That was, even though I guess that is the first rule of, there's like 1,000 or 3,000, I think, lists, and you only get the first couple rules or some random rules in there, but figuring out that they love the living and that they like don't judge us, and that they really want everyone to have a second chance and to live as like sort of take as much advantage of life as possible, because they just really want to be alive for one more day. Like some of them just want to like eat a chocolate cake or like go for a run or whatever they want. They want to take advantage of one more day. So they feel like every day that we're still alive is precious. And those, so loving the living and then not being able to meddle were the things that were the most important rules that I set for myself.
Yeah. And so I love every time a ghost speaks, we get a birthday and a death day. And
so that comes from living in the cemetery. So I lived in the cemetery, you know, before I was really had the idea to write a book that was set in the cemetery, but I lived in the cemetery, lived with my dog Harvey in this groundskeeper's house and walked him every day. And, you know, as I'm waiting for him to do his business, I'm just reading the cemetery. And so looking at the gravestones every day, and I felt like I was always trying to pay attention to when people lived and died so I could just think about them, you know, I was just kind of, in and I'm like a baby writer trying to think about stories all the time. And so I became like really interested in reading gravestones at that point. So that also happened as soon as I, that was something that I thought naturally do. Like it's part of their name because it's right there when you read them all the time.
Right, yeah. And then of course, this is like such a quirky and wonderful and funny book. But the thing that you notice as a reader right away is that there are so many ghosts who were born in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, so I definitely tried to balance death dates across like whenever the town began, but I think the ghosts that died more recently are more invested in what's going on in the town. And also because there are ways, as I explained in the rules, that you may not be a ghost anymore. So like Absalon Kelsey, the oldest ghost, is still around in the graveyard. And I think part of it is because he still has descendants in the town. And so he's still able to be really invested in the living. So once you stop being invested in the living in the town, the ghosts move on to another place.
Well, that may be. I hope they're all reunited with their pets.
Well, I didn't really want to solve totally the like what happens when we die.
Just a little bit.
Like this is one, and I don't think it's purgatory either. Like it's purgatory in like in the Bardo, but I did not imagine this at all as purgatory. It's just like one plane of existence. But once you're able to let go, and this happened in sort of a crazy way, that now I'm only realizing this as I'm talking to you, is that when my dog Harvey died, the one I'm talking about walking around the cemetery, I went to see, I was like a wreck. I was not in a good place. And so I went to see a dog medium, and now I get two emails from strangers. I get emails that like, they liked my book, or they read my essay about going to see a dog medium and can I please give them her information? I'd probably send like almost 100, like here's where you find her. Wendy@centerforpetloss.com.
I'm gonna tell my mom right away.
She's worth whatever she costs. I think it was like $75. And so I talked to her and she was talking about, for humans, they have such a hard time letting go, but for animals, because they live so much in the moment, that Harvey was not like holding on to either. Really, he missed me and loved me, but it was so much easier for him that he was just like soaring now and he was free and he was not like, he was still connected with me, but he was also just like, he was letting go. She said, it's so much easier for animals. He's soaring now. He's like a bald eagle.
And I love that. And I love the idea that like, yeah, Harvey didn't have a bucket list. like all of these things that needed to be resolved.
Yeah. So it helped me so much that it wasn't like he's in heaven and he's thinking about you all the time. He's waiting for you, like the rainbow bridge that people always say is comforting.
That's so painful.
That's worse. That's so bad. He's just sitting there at the end of the bridge waiting for you to walk over. Like, oh my God, what could be more horrible for me to say?
Awful.
Like, should I go on the Rainbow Bridge right now if he's waiting there, you know?
And I would be like, I can imagine when my mom's dog died that she'd be like, I'm coming.
Yeah.
But I love that, the idea that the thing to admire about animals and the thing that all of the people of Everton admire about animals living and dead,
mm-hmm.
is that they are all present.
Yeah. And that letting go is not hard for them.
Yeah.
And that's like, if you've ever accidentally kicked your dog, they're not like, you kicked me. They're like, oh my God, sorry. Was I in your way? Like,
yeah.
Not that I always accidentally, we never kick a dog, obviously.
Annie, this is so interesting to me though, because when I was asking you about the ghosts born in the 80s and 90s, what I thought you were going to say was that it illustrates the impact of the opioid crisis in New Hampshire.
Oh yeah, that's part of it too. Yes, I was thinking the book is about, sort of the opioid crisis leaked in as I'm writing about this real place. And so I had to have, so I guess there's two reasons that there are ghosts that whether or not they were born in the 80s or 90s, but that died more recently. So there are some people who lived, you know, until their 80s, but they died recently. But then there are a bunch of young ghosts who didn't who lived until they were, you know, 24 or something. And that is because those are generally people that that were lost to the opioid crisis, and that became part of the book as I was writing, which I did not intend to write about at all. But as I'm researching the town, it became something that felt like true to life, and I felt like I sort of had to do it, or wanted to address it. I don't really feel like I have to do anything because because I'm not that type of writer that's trying to get I'm trying to get emotional truth, not not real truth. And that felt like something that is emotionally true to the people in the cemetery.
And it's, I think it adds a layer of, you know, so the story focuses on Emma, the living woman who returns to her family home and becomes a substitute teacher. But her brother, Augie, is a recovering addict, and her best friend from high school, like the kind that you're obsessed with and feels like a romantic relationship partly, is also grappling with addiction. Depicting the harms that come from addiction is such an interesting counterbalance to the idea that there are all of these animals that people are trying to domesticate.
I think there's something interesting that you are getting at that I haven't really thought about, but the book is so much. So the book is like, the real heart of the story is the young woman comes home to take care of her dying father. She was born with a slight healing touch in her hands, and she has been sort of told all her life that she is special and that she's going to heal people. So that's the magic element in the book. But she has come home, she's to her dying father, who's hallucinating, and he's suffering from sort of brain disease that the doctors don't really know how to make sense of, but they know that he's not long for this world. And she knows that if she ever really had like whatever healing touch she has or had, it would never be enough to save her father from this brain disease. And then at the same time, her brother has been suffering with an addiction problem for several years and has gone to rehab a couple times. And she's been out in California with this healing touch and knowing that she can do nothing about that either. And so she's also just stayed away completely from, I think she's failed her brother in that way, just not being around, which is something that sort of gets worked out in the book. But I think, and I've never thought about how the animals and how the opioid crisis are connected, or the domestication stuff, but I think that there's a lot about caretaking. Yeah. And there's a lot about wanting to help people and wanting to take care of animals and wanting to control them. And then there's a lot about parenting, but taking care of your parents and then how they have tried to take care of you and do the best for you. And sort of this wanting the best for your loved ones, and also letting people make their own decisions. And that's sort of like what you can learn from trying to domesticate a fox, that there's limits to how much you can control someone else's choices. You're not going to stop a fox from ripping up a pillow or whatever. And then there are limits to how you can control your adult children. And then there are limits when you're an adult children to how much you can control your parents, which is from my sort of where I sit, like more something that I've struggled with, as trying to figure out, you know, how do I reason with my parents about certain things? Mm-hmm. And that is an interesting, it was one of the main things that I was thinking about and struggling with is just realizing as you become an adult that you think, like, as you're a kid, you're like, once I'm an adult, I'll be this all powerful and everyone will listen to me. And then you realize, and also that when you're a kid, your parents are perfect. And then you realize that well, they're powerless against the world, and so are you. And you're, and you can't save them from dying. And so I think that there's a lot there that is like touching each other in ways that is kind of the fun part of writing something that where you have a lot of things going on, that they do interact with each other in ways, even in ways that I don't fully realize sometimes. And I know this book is a crazy book to talk about, because I did want a book that was sort of overstuffed and you're looking at a lot of different things, and then it, like a John Irving novel, all comes together in the end. And so there are ways that I've really thought about how everything comes together and has to all interact. And then there are other things that I'm like, oh, those are things that I think are related through a theme of caretaking or something, but through having these conversations, it's like, oh, okay, I understand it on a deeper level now than I think I even did before.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, you really make this town come alive too, not just the dead people. And you write so you have so many funny scenes at the elementary school where Emma teaches, and the community theater production of Titanic the musical with an exclamation point.
Well, the kids are probably my favorite scenes to write, or anything with the kids, because I love writing children and the funny things that they say. And also, they are what the dead people in the town care about the most is people getting second chances. And sort of the younger you are, the more they love you and care about you, because that's, you know, they all want one more day alive, but they want the children to have as many days as possible. And so Clive, the father that's dying in the book, I wanted him to be young, like not, I thought a lot about, and I wrote this pre-COVID, or, you know, I edited a lot of it after COVID, but I thought a lot about what's an acceptable death and what's an unacceptable death. And a child's death is always an unacceptable death. And then the older you get, you know, if you will go to a 91-year-old's funeral, like people are much more comfortable at the whole thing. They can tell more jokes, and it can be more of a celebration of life and not like this is a horrible tragedy. So Clive is 68, which is short. A lot of people would say that's too short, but it's also, you know, not the horrible tragedy in the same way that, you know, maybe a 14-year-old's death would be. So the children are both like sort of the hope for the future, and also the people that the cemetery wants to protect the most. And that both added a lot of humor, and also me trying to figure out, you know, who is allowed to be hurt in this book, and the children have to be protected at all costs.
I love that. And then, of course, in terms of being heard, you also, Moses the dog gets a little bit of a spotlight as well, and Rasputin the fox.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about, like, yeah, making them characters.
Like characters. So I realized that if the people, the dead people in the town could hear anybody's thoughts, that I could have a lot of fun with that. So very early on, I had Moses as point of view. And it's just here and there, although there was at one point, there was a whole chapter. And I forget if it was my agent or my editor who's like, that's too much, doc. but it took me actually a long time until I think like after we sold the book, after I was editing for a while, to realize like, why doesn't the fox have a point of view? if I could, like, because it was so easy for me to jump right into the dog's head. And I was like, obviously here's what he's thinking. He gets to a new field and it was like, great place, smells amazing. But the fox was much more like how you would put a fox in a regular book, that just like, there's a fox, hello. He's gonna do all these crazy things, but you're never gonna know what he's thinking. And then, I realized at some point, I clicked, I was like, oh wait, of course I can have his point of view. And wouldn't that be fun to have something that's half wild, half, and that again, I always go too far and then have to edit back. So originally, and this is not appear in the book, the fox is from Russia, which is where there are real foxes. domesticated. There was a whole domestication process, project that that went on starting in the 60s, I think. And so this fox originally arrived speaking tons and tons of Russian swears. And my brother, thankfully, is no longer living in Russia, but had been living in Russia for the past several years. And so he, who had not read any of the book, did not know what I'm writing about. I was always WhatsApping him and saying, all right, how do you say this Russian swear? And he was always saying, you know, the Russian swear or the is always much, much worse than you would think you would say to someone you dislike. So he would be like, this whole string of horrible things that the fox would be saying to the mother in the book. She was his main. So that you know, I went way too far, and then I had to. So now the fox still has some great lines, but it's much, much less, which is sort of how I write anyway.
You'll have to give us deleted scenes at some point.
It was really fun to ask my brother, to involve my brother in any way, but.
That's great, Annie. Unlikely animals. I feel like we barely even scratched the surface, but this has been a great talk. And before we go, would you like to recommend some books for us?
So I've just read a bunch of good ones. I actually have to recommend a book that won't come out until August based on what we've been talking about, Good Grief by E.B. Bartels, which is about sort of how we mourn our pets after they, not just dogs, but all pets, cats, birds. So that one comes out in August, and actually my dog Harvey makes an appearance in it, a very brief paragraph about how I mourned him. And so that one is, I think, going to be helpful for a lot of people, and is also just super entertaining and well researched. Then I read How High We Go in the Dark by Sequoia Nagamatsu. Mm-hmm. And that I thought was so inventive, and I just really appreciated how sort of wild his imagination is. And that people asked me if that was too bleak, and I didn't find it too bleak because it was so inventive. And then the last, I guess I just listened to yesterday, The Notes on an Execution. And I love that. And I thought that was a really good audiobook. I've been listening to a lot of
audiobooks.
Yeah, really good audiobook. So those are my main recs right now.
Well, that's perfect. Thank you so much, Annie.
Thank you for having me. This was awesome.
I know you a little better now.
Perfect.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.